This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk about a cover story in the Baton Rouge Business Report this week regarding Rod Dreher, the LSU journalism graduate and celebrated conservative intellectual who has moved back home to St. Francisville after many years on the national scene. He started his career at the Baton Rouge Advocate. He has come back home amid claims that Louisiana is losing its best and brightest as many of our bright lights are moving to other places for greater opportunity. We'll talk about the piece written by Rod Dreher. Also on the show, John Hightower, who's involved in many things in our community. We will discuss with him a few of his endeavors, a man who works at the LSU Law Center and is a fixture at the Baton Rouge Press Club, John Hightower. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Hope your week's off to a good start. The numbers to call if you'd like to engage our guests in conversation. 297-5633 is the local number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest is Rod Dreher, a senior editor at the American Conservative, author of the memoir The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, released this month by Grand Central Publishing. Rod has the cover story in the current edition of the Baton Rouge Business Report, and it's about his odyssey around the country as a journalist, a celebrated one at that, and his return home to St. Francisville a few years ago. Good morning, Rod Dreher.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jim.
Well, nice to see you, and you were educated at LSU and went to work immediately for the Baton Rouge Advocate. You were doing film reviews and that sort of thing, what John Wirt does now, I think. And from there, you went to the Washington Times, and then I don't want to get carried away too much, but you've been around the country a few times and back, it seems, during the last 20 years or so. Where did you go?
Well, after I finished in Washington, D.C., I was covering Congress, but realized that budget hearings were not my cup of tea. I went down to South Florida and get back into arts journalism at the Sun Sentinel. I then became the chief film critic at the New York Post, and my wife and I had a wonderful 5 years in New York. Went to Dallas, worked for the Dallas Morning News, and then to Philadelphia for the Templeton Foundation. And it was 6 weeks after we moved to Philly that we got the terrible news that my sister Ruthie, who taught school in West Feliciana Parish, had been diagnosed with lung cancer.
And you came home.
We did, after she died. You know, she lived for 19 months, even though her oncologist, Dr. Joe Militello, told me that she had 2.5 months to live when she was diagnosed. Well, she lived 19, something he credits to, of course, medicine, but also her faith. She was a very strong Christian, and also the community she had around her in St. Francisville and Star Hill in West Feliciana that rallied to her side and gave her the strength she needed to beat the odds. But after she died, my wife, Julie, and I came down for the funeral, of course, and we had been watching from afar the incredible love that the West Feliciana community had shown to Ruthie and to her husband, her kids, my mom and dad. And standing there at the visitation at the United Methodist Church in St. Francisville, and the line of people there to greet our family and to pay their respects was over 1,000 people long. And this is in a town of 1,700. I kept meeting people, Jim, who said to me, "Sir, you don't know me." I hadn't been there for 30 years almost. "Sir, you don't know me, but your sister taught me, and here's what she did for me. Sir, you don't know me, but she taught our kids. Here's what she did for me." And I began to see in that, I had an epiphany. I saw that the value of this community that I'd left and never thought I'd go back to. And that's when we decided we need to be here.
297-5633 if you'd like to talk with Rod Dreher, who has returned home, lives in St. Francisville, is still active in journalism, and his second book is out and about, and he writes about his experience with his sister and his return home in the current issue of the Baton Rouge Business Report. The book is The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, who was, 40 or 41 when she died?
She was 42, 40 when she was diagnosed.
Okay. You said a year ahead, this is how you set it up in the business report. A year and a half ago, I moved with my wife and children from Philadelphia back to St. Francisville, where I was born and raised. Today, I don't have much more faith in Louisiana's functionality, political or otherwise, than I had nearly 30 years ago, but I have a lot more faith in Louisiana, so much that I came back home to raise our own children. I did this with open eyes and a changed heart. The changed heart, I would presume, occurred because of the experience of your sister.
That's right. Ruthie and I were very different people. We were both raised out in the country in Star Hill, just south of St. Francisville. She was the country mouse. I was the city mouse. She was always going hunting with our dad and helping him fix fence. Always wanted to be outside, usually in bare feet. I always wanted to be inside, usually with my head in a book. I became an avid indoorsman, Jim. Avid indoorsman, that's me. And, you know, we were just very different people that way. And I wanted to get away as fast as I could to go off and test myself in the big city, go have fun elsewhere. My elderly aunts, Lois and Hilda, I grew up around them, and they had been Red Cross nurses in World War I. From right there in Star Hill, they went to Dijon, France, to the front. That was so interesting to me. Plus, I had to deal with bullying in high school, and it was a really painful thing. And I left St. Francisville for Louisiana School in Natchitoches, feeling really embittered about the town. I thought, this is what a small town is. It's intolerant. People are bullies can rule the roost here. Ruthie never had that experience. She loved everything about our town, and the only time she ever really left was to go to LSU for 4 years, get her education degree, and go home to teach. And I was happy for her. I could see that she was thriving in her career, teaching at the West Feliciana Middle School. But I was thriving in my career, too, living off in the world, and never thought I'd come back and live in a small town.
But she was your compass. Inevitably, you thought of her, I'm sure, when you thought of home, and then suddenly she was gone, and it's almost like you have filled her void.
Well, you know, that's really true. I realized as Ruthie was dying that I had always thought that I could go as far as I wanted to in the world because Ruthie was going to be home in Star Hill anchoring things. Mm-hmm. You know, she was the fixed point in the world because she never wanted to leave. She was a complete country girl. But when suddenly Ruthie's gone, I had to stop and think, I'm the only one left. There were just two of us. And her husband, Mike, is still there, and their girls are still there if they choose to stay there. But what is my role? What is my responsibility to this family, to my mom and dad, who are still alive, to Mike and the girls? Not only that, not only my responsibility, but what is the opportunity to have them be a part of my life and the life of my three children?
Mm-hmm. The story, I'm told, has generated more response than any story in recent times in the business report, and it's entitled The Case for Coming Home. The nationally known author explains how culture played a key role in his decision to return to Louisiana. 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, for Rod Dreher, Reverend Chris Andrews downtown. Good morning, Chris. You're on with Rod.
Good morning, Jim and Mr. Dreher. I am enjoying this conversation in a very poignant way. I had a brief opportunity to be a part of Ruthie's life, and Mr. Dreher, you may not remember, you wrote me a very warm and lovely letter. And I just want to say it's good to have someone like you back in our community. Welcome home.
Well, thank you so much, Pastor. I do well remember how you came and ministered to Ruthie during the last months of her life. That meant the world to her and to my family that you extended yourself, even though you barely knew her. That's what this community is about, you know, Jim. The love that the people of Louisiana showed to my family, I realized when I was standing outside the Methodist Church in St. Francisville that the tight community bonds that when I was a 15-year-old felt like they were holding me down and holding me back, these were the only things that was holding my family together during their crisis. And the world looks a lot different when you're 45 than when you're 15. And I also thought, you know, I say in the business report story that when I was an undergraduate at LSU and working at The Advocate in the late 80s, early 90s, I was so fed up with the wizard and the lizard and all that business. I thought that Louisiana's totally screwed up and they value parades more than libraries. Off I go. Well, come to find out, in the middle of my life, that parades mean a lot more than I thought they did. Parades being a metaphor for not only for actual parades, but for the crawfish boils, the tailgating, the creek parties, the things that Ruthie did and took as part of everyday life. That was what gave substance and joy to her life, and I found I needed that.
Where's your wife from?
Dallas.
How does she like St. Francisville?
Oh, she loves it. She's made great friends there. She loves gardening, and we just got permission to put chickens in our backyard in town. So, she's fitting wonderfully well there.
297-5633 to talk with Rod Dreher, who is a celebrated writer. Quite an elegant story, the cover story in the latest Business Report about his return back home. And he's been a journalist now for well over 25 years. I guess that odyssey started with the Daily Reveille, didn't it?
It started with the Daily Reveille. I wanted to stay in Baton Rouge one summer. I didn't want to go home and sit in St. Francisville. So I told my dad I really needed to take some classes, and I got a job at the Daily Reveille. I was studying political science and thought, well, this could be fun, writing about politics for the Reveille. And I found I had a knack for it. And Jay Perkins recruited me for the journalism program. And next thing you know, I won a National Journalism Award for editorial writing. And that sealed the deal.
I recall a story you wrote about Abby Hoffman.
Oh, how we almost got arrested on the campus of the Jimmy Swagger Bible College.
Wasn't he running around the campus?
Drunk as a skunk, yeah. And I was kind of responsible for that. I was the one who helped bring him here as part of the Ideas and Issues Committee. He celebrated 60s radical, and I thought this was the coolest thing. And we went out to the bayou on Chime Street, the late lamented bayou, and I wanted to talk politics with him. And all my friends, my political friends at LSU, wanted to talk politics with Abby. He just wanted to chase women. And he got drunk as a skunk, and we ended up running around the campus of the Jimmy Swaggart Bible College with him yelling at the Jimmy Swaggart Bible police, and it was a close call.
He was yelling Jewish heathen on campus.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
I remember the story, and when you were with him on Chime Street, he was trying to make the acquaintance of a, quote, bowhead, right?
That's right. That's a very very polite way to put it. He was being rather crude, but yeah, he didn't care about politics. He just cared about women.
But when the man died, I think the headline was Abby Hoffman, no tears, or something something like that. He ended up taking his life shortly thereafter.
He did. It was a sad thing because I watched him get drunk that night after the political speech, which had been inspiring. And I watched him under the table shake pills into his hand and pop pills. And he had a gambling problem, too. He was late for the speech. I had to go pick him up. He was late for the speech because he was on the phone with his bookie and told me he had...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he told me he had more riding on the Mets game that night than he did on the speech that he was going to make at LSU. So that offered me a real back, kind of behind-the-scenes look at political idealism.
All right, Stephanie Regal calling from, I presume, the offices of the Business Report. Stephanie, you're on with your former colleague, Rod Dreher.
Good morning. And, you know, Jim, as you mentioned, we had so much positive feedback from that story. And I think it's not only because Rod is such a fabulous writer, which he is, but because this issue and this subject matter really touched a nerve with so many people, not only here, but all over the country. And, you know, one thing I've been exploring as I keep talking it up with everybody is how unique, Rod, do you think you really are in South Louisiana? I mean, would it be the same if you were from the Mississippi Delta or the Florida Panhandle or, you know, the foothills of Alabama? Or is something really indigenous to us here in Louisiana? Or maybe because 80% of the people who are born here stay here and don't leave. What is it that gives us this sense of community in place?
That's a great question, Stephanie. It's hard for me to know because I was raised here, as you know, and I have lived around the country mostly in big cities. But I find that wherever I've lived, the Louisiana expatriate community comes together and we talk about home. And I think what it is the joie de vivre we have here, the pleasure we take in life. I remember when we came, I came home for Ruthie right after Ruthie died. I went over to her house there in Star Hill, flew in from Philly, expecting to find this very grim scene. And in fact, it was a joyful scene. Her friends were surrounding Mike and holding him up, and they were drinking beer and laughing and telling funny Ruthie stories. And that continued throughout the the mourning period.
297-5633. We'll return with Rod Dreher after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Rod Dreher is with us, the conservative columnist and commentator and reporter and a man who is very active in journalism and has been for the last quarter century. Starting with his days at the LSU Reveille, he is now a senior editor with the American Conservative and author of the memoir, The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, about the passing of his sister, who died after a 19-month battle with lung cancer, never smoked. And in his story that is in the Baton Rouge Business Report, he starts by saying, in the autumn of 1987, I sat at my computer terminal in the Daily Reveille office in the basement of Hodges Hall on the LSU campus and punched out a bitter op-ed commentary about Louisiana state politics. I can't be sure, but I think it had to do with then-Governor Edwin Edwards' campaign statement that if Louisiana's best and brightest wanted to leave the state, well, good riddance. And then ultimately, Rod Dreher leaves, and now he is back, has been for a while now, and he was in full bloom when we went to the break about what is inspiring and enduring about Louisiana that may be reasons to stay rather than go.
Right. I was told by a friend of mine, a Louisiana expatriate who works in Washington, D.C., he said, you know, what's so great about our home state is it's okay to be average there. You know, that you can, you don't have to achieve, and prove your worth by how far you've gotten in business or politics or in your education. People are going to love you anyway. It's not that they don't value excellence. It's that they value the human side more than anything else. He said, you can't imagine what that's like when you work in a place like Washington where they only value you on what you can do. Just to be accepted by people for just being your family and neighbor. That's what Louisiana is to me.
HB in Denham Springs. Good morning, HB. You're on with Rod.
Good morning, Mr. Rod. You were talking about your past memories. This Saturday, 300-plus people celebrated their 50th graduation ceremonies from Estruma High School at the Oak Place on Sherwood Forest Boulevard. Dr. Clyde Lindsay was our guest speaker toward the end of it, and many of us were talking that we just wished that we could have sent our children and grandchildren to Estruma and Dalton Elementary School in the 70805 zone. But Dr. Clyde Lindsay, in his presentation, told us the reasons that we have such a problem in our school system, and one only needs to ask Dr. Clyde what happened to Estruma and Dalton and all that. But it's just a memory lane that we all wish that we could have done, and many of us are out of state now, or at least out of the parish.
All right. Where will you be sending your kids? They are how old now?
My kids are 13, 9, and 6.
Well,
and
yeah, they're in school right now, so are they going to public schools?
No, we homeschool them. We've been homeschooling since we lived in Dallas, and we continued homeschooling in Philadelphia. We were part of a homeschool co-op because we found that really works for us. West Feliciana has great schools, and you know, it's possible our kids may go to school there, but right now homeschooling is what we do.
You said you were a victim of bullying when you were in school?
I was, Jim, and it was a pretty significant event in my life. In fact, I think I probably got my politics to a certain extent from that experience, strange as it may seem. I was on a trip. It wasn't an official school trip, mm-hmm. but these were, you know, a bunch of us kids went to the beach. I was 14, and bullies held me down, tried to humiliate me. And the adults, there were a couple of chaperones there, they stepped over me to get out of the room. And that really affected me, seriously. But do you know, I found out just last week, a reader was reading my book, and she wrote me and said, I don't know if you remember, I was on that trip too, and they did the same thing to me. And it really gave me such a sense of compassion. And I've tried to be compassionate too over the course of my life, especially when it comes to bullying kids. That's why I took on the Catholic Church scandal, which was probably the most significant thing I've ever written about, because I felt like I had to defend those children.
Well, yeah, since you brought it up, you were raised a Catholic, right?
No, I was raised Methodist. I converted to Catholicism as a young adult when I became serious about Christianity.
Okay, so you actually converted to Catholicism, which is heavy duty. It's not something you just go down and sign. It's not like changing your voting registration. You have to go through some hoops to do it, but you're no longer a Catholic.
No, I was a very devout and convinced Catholic for about 13 years. And then when I was in New York, I started writing about the abuse scandal before it broke big in Boston. And I felt that it was urgently necessary as a faithful Catholic and as a journalist to write about this and to tell the truth of what's happening and to bring justice for these children and families. A good priest I know who has sacrificed his own career to stand up for these kids told me, you be careful about this, because if you keep going this way, you're going to see things darker than you mm-hmm. ever imagined existed. Well, that's catnip to a journalist. Plus, I felt like I had to do this if I was in a position to help these kids. And it turned out it cost me my Catholic faith. I'm still a Christian. I became an Orthodox Christian, and I'm grateful for that. And I'm not angry at the Catholic Church. I thank God for the Catholic Church and all the beautiful things it gave me. But I did not realize how much the trauma of the bullying as a child would affect me and my emotional response to the abuse scandal.
You worked at the New York Post for 5 years. You lived in the city?
We did. We lived in Manhattan when we first moved there, and then we moved to Brooklyn. And that's where my first son was born. We were there on 9/11.
How was that experience?
You know, it's hard even today to explain what happened there. I remember being on the Brooklyn Bridge, heading it toward the danger to write my column for the New York Post about the fire, and I ran into a friend, a colleague, and I said, let's get down there. She said, don't go down there. Those things are coming down. I said, they're not going to come down. That's a Twin Towers. But down they came. And I learned how vulnerable life is. But I also learned, Jim, in the aftermath that followed, how a community can come together in the face of tragedy in a beautiful way. I saw the similar thing happen when my sister got sick. And it just goes to show you that community is not something that only exists in small towns. It can exist in big cities, too, as long as we place love of each other and service to each other ahead of all our petty concerns.
How is it working for Rupert Murdoch?
Right now?
Well, then. And now.
Oh, how is it working? Yeah, well, you know, Murdoch is one of these amazing people. I remember we had dinner with him on his yacht right after I got there. He wanted to meet some of the new people on staff. And I was scared to death. I mean, this is Murdoch. But the man, when you're with him, he's very personable, like most Australians are. But you can tell his mind is soaring at 30,000 feet, and he's always calculating. But I remember one of the most impressive things about him was every now and then you'd see him in the Post newsroom with his sleeves rolled up, looking over the next day's front page, making decisions. This is a man running a multi-billion-dollar international media company, but there he is, the old newspaper man.
297-5633 for Rod Dreher, who is a conservative, and you say your political epiphany occurred in part because of your experiences of being bullied as a young man in St. Francisville. How did that affect your politics?
Well, it made me very suspicious of authority. You know, it made me see the need for authority and suspicious of the mob, too. But I saw in that case, I don't want to extrapolate too much from something that happened in a hotel room, but I saw how the mob, how good people can get swept up in emotion and victimize the weak. But I also saw how authority can be afraid to confront the mob and let the weak be victimized. And that affected the way I've seen politics all my life. On the other hand, what happened in Ruthie's case, seeing the community, that same community come together and love and sacrifice made me see the other side of it, you know?
Right.
And so I feel like we live in tension between state power and the power of the community, and we have to live in creative tension there, but it's something that I'm continuing to work through in my own mind.
It's interesting because I could have a liberal sitting in the chair you're sitting in right now, and they could say exactly the same thing on why they're a liberal. The mob against the individual. But in American politics, as you know, today, there is a great polarization. Will that change, or is that something we're going to have to grin and bear?
I think for the time being, we're going to have to grin and bear it because there seem to be no creative ideas coming out of either the left or the right. I mean, I'm a conservative. I quit being a Republican. When I came back to Louisiana, I signed up as an independent because I'm fed up with my own party. I think that we haven't done anything sensible since the end of the Bush administration on foreign policy or economics, but I don't have any belief in the liberals either. I feel, Jim, for my sake, I need to get involved in localism. You know, culture precedes politics, And cultural change happens, I think, by people doing what the people of St. Francisville did for my sister and do for each other every single day and loving each other. Whether you're liberal or conservative, you can serve your community, and it doesn't really matter. I'm not saying politics aren't important, but I'll tell you, I got a review the other day from Yuval Levin, who's one of the premier policy analysts of the conservatives of his generation. He wrote a National Review online, this amazing review, A Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, called it the most powerful book he's read in years. And I wrote back to him and said, thank you so much for that. I've been admiring your analysis for many years. I'd never expected this from you. He said, well, I juggle data all day, and I try to figure out policy solutions to our problems. But when you read a story like this about how real people behave in a real town, you realize that the story is where the power is. And I think maybe now I'll be telling stories. not offering opinions, but telling stories.
The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming is the book about his brave sister. You obviously were close to as children, not too far in age. You're a little bit older than she, but what?
2 years older than Ruthie. And the thing is, and this is one thing I found on the book tour, people have told me that they love about this book, is that Ruthie is not a plaster saint. I mean, she was good, but she was not a goody-goody. And she and I didn't get along all the time. I was about the only person in the world she didn't treat with absolute, you know, boundless kindness. But that makes it real. You know, families are difficult. Families are hard and big and real and dirty, as my friend Edie Varnado said. And, you know, I had to figure out a way to accept Ruthie's love and to love her back, even though we were both broken in certain ways.
Did she share your political viewpoints?
You know, Ruthie wasn't political. Ruthie was probably much more a conventional conservative than I was, than I am. But we never talked about politics. She didn't have any interest in it. When we were at LSU, I remember she came to the cafeteria, Highland Cafeteria. I was sitting there with my best friend. We were talking about our philosophy class and Nietzsche and the death of God and things like that, big ideas. She sat down, listened to that for a couple of minutes and said, "You boys are full of crap. So get out there and do something with your lives. Don't just sit here and talking these big ideas." That was Ruthie Lemming. She wanted to do things. For her, ideas were distractions from the good you ought to be out there doing to help people.
Well, and you've done that. But what can a journalist do, even one of national scope, as you are, do to affect public opinion and action?
You can tell stories. I mean, there. I've spent most of my career writing analyses and opinion pieces and exhortations to people to do this or oppose that. But I find, Jim, since I published this book and since I started telling stories about Ruthie Lemming and about the people of St. Francisville, this is what gets to people, whether they're on the left or the right. I told my wife when I got back from the book tour the other day, 2 weeks out on the road around the country, I've been so impressed by how much pain people carry, you know, and I say impressed in the sense that you just don't see people like that. You know, you see the guy, your neighbor walking down the street, they look like they're fine. They may not be fine. People have heard me talk about Ruthie and the compassion she showed to people and what her neighbor showed to her. And they come to my table, won't say, "Please sign this book for my mom. I haven't talked to her in 10 years. Maybe this will break the ice." Things like that make me realize that we need to be telling these stories of good things that happen in the world, because that's how healing can really take place.
297-5633, still time to get in with Rod Dreher, and I'll go to some listeners who have posed questions at inkstershow.org. Kevin wants to know your opinion of Governor Jindal. What do you think of him?
You know, I have not paid close attention to Louisiana state politics since I came back at the end of 2011, because I immediately started writing the book. And my own focus in my political life has been to focus on cultural politics, usually at a national level. I had high hopes for Governor Jindal when he was elected. I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal back then saying, "Hooray, finally we're saved." But it seems to have been kind of a Buddy Romer rerun moment, hasn't it, when he just hasn't seemed to have lived up to his promise. I will say that he seems like a great guy to me, but on the national level, when I've seen when he has spoken to a national audience, he just hasn't had much new to say.
All right. Ariane at inkstershow.org wants to know your opinion of where the Republican Party stands today. I guess she's referring to the recent elections that were not as productive as Republicans thought they would be.
Now, I would like to see the Republican Party, you know, with which I identify, even though I'm no longer officially a Republican, take a more creative and thoughtful stance on foreign policy. You know, the Iraq War was a disaster. I supported the Iraq War when it happened, and I remember some conservatives affiliated with the magazine I now work for, the American Conservative, said, "Wait a minute, let's not rush into this." Well, I thought they were wrong, they were cowardly, they were this, they were that. I was wrong. I would like to see the Republican Party have less interest in supporting big business and Wall Street, more in supporting small business, because I believe that is the real backbone of this country. And I think that, and Yuval Levin said this at the Ethics and Public Policy Center when he reviewed Little Way. He said, "For me, conservatism is about creating the conditions where communities like St. Francisville's can arise mm-hmm. and thrive. We can't depend on the government to do everything, but the government can do some things. And I think that insofar, generally speaking, as a Republican Party can get back on the side of the little guy, I think that there will be a future there. But we just don't see any sort of creative rethinking of the disaster that befell the party in the Bush years."
297-5633 for Rod Dreher, a thoughtful man who obviously has some tough words for both political parties. And my guess is that you're not a real fan of the president.
No, I'm not. But I don't hate the guy like so many on my side seem to do. I don't understand the rage that he provoked. But then again, I didn't understand the rage that George Bush provoked among so many on the left. I mean, whether you like their policies or not, both President Bush and President Obama seem to be fundamentally decent men. And I guess I feel like Mike Huckabee once said, "I'm a conservative, but I'm not angry about it."
Okay. Kobe writes on Drusilla. He says, "This week we saw some of the best journalism we've seen in quite a while," or I guess referring to the Boston situation. "What can ordinary citizens do to help improve journalism in this country?"
You can buy newspapers, you know. You can listen to the radio. You can contribute to your public radio station. There's so many good things you can do if you just get active and realize that these things don't exist. Public radio or newspapers or even television stations don't exist as a public utility. They need to be supported. If you don't subscribe to the paper, why not? Mm-hmm. You know, even if you get it online, you need to do that, because as we've seen over and over, you've seen it with the Baton Rouge Advocate, you've seen it with every paper in the country, they're struggling. Somebody's got to pay the salaries of reporters.
What did you think of the Picayune going to 3 days a week?
I thought it was a tragedy, but I thought it was inevitable. You know, we'll see what happens with the Advocate. You know, I'm excited in a way about John George buying it, just because I want to see what he can do. These are terrible times for newspapers. I mean, your listeners know that. And we need to do some radical things in newspapers to try to save ourselves.
The same company that owns the New Orleans Times-Picayune also owns the Cleveland Plain Dealer, another legendary newspaper. It also went to 3 days a week last week. So we'll talk more with Rod Dreher about journalism and politics and his book, The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, about the brave struggle and triumph of his sister, who died with lung cancer, never smoked, died at 42. And that experience returned Rod Dreher home to Louisiana once again. We'll also hear from the remarkable John Hightower after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Rod Dreher with us for a few more minutes. You may reach us by email as well, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we'll also hear from John Hightower, a man about town. If there is one, he is one. Now, the book, The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, was prompted by the struggle and death of Rod Dreher's sister. His return home to Louisiana is chronicled in this week's business report, The Case for Coming Home. Do you think you'll stay? You're 46. You got a lot of miles in the tank. You going to stay or are you going to go?
God willing, we'll be here for the rest of our lives. I'm so happy to be home. it's been a beautiful, wonderful thing. It's been a healing. And that was my sister's last gift to me, you know, to make it possible for me to come home. I remember when Ruthie was so sick, right after she was diagnosed, we were all so worried about her. And she was so cheerful and joyful during her illness and tried to cheer everybody up. And she said to me, Rod, we just don't know what God's going to do with this. Well, part of what God's doing with this was bringing me home and my family home. And this book is changing so many lives. I'm hearing from people all over the country who are being healed by this. And I think Ruthie would be so happy.
I'm sure she would. And maybe in some way she is hearing your voice right now. But it was an experience that I'm sure was shocking. How did you react when she was diagnosed?
Oh, it was absolutely devastating. You don't expect this from a woman who had never smoked, was healthy, three kids, had done everything right in life. But you know, Jim, from a philosophical point of view, if something like this can happen to Ruthie Lemming, it could happen to any of us. Mm-hmm. And I began to realize over the course of her illness and seeing all the people who rallied to the family side, I said to my wife, what would happen if this happened to us? We were living in Philly then. We were fairly new in Philly. You know, we had friends there, but we had not had been there long enough to build the deep bench, you know, that Ruthie had from having lived there all her life. And so it kind of makes you realize what really matters in life and how much other people matter.
You're obviously a man of faith, as was your sister, and that is another question that permeates politics. Do you think there's hostility toward belief and religion from the American left?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's, you know, I think that's one reason why I couldn't consider being a Democrat, even though I sympathize with a lot of what Democrats believe in. They're just such a hostility to believers there, and I wish it weren't the case, but I think it's going to get worse. I really do, but we're called to love no matter what, mm-hmm. and my own faith has been challenged greatly by what I've seen in Ruthie and what I've seen in people I've met in talking about Ruthie, people who are liberal and conservative. We're all people underneath it all, and we all need to forgive each other and show mercy to each other.
That said, the most religious people in this country as far as church-going and tithing, you name it, they're African-Americans who are almost overwhelmingly Democratic. So I think Democrats sometimes get a bad name as far as their opinions and their beliefs regarding a higher power and their adherence to a religious perspective.
Oh, it's about the elites in the Democratic Party, not the grassroots. I know I have friends of mine who are liberal Democrats who believe in God as strongly as I do. But at the national level, it's a different story. And in other parts of the country, it's a different story. I lived in New York City, right? I was in New York a couple weeks ago on the book tour and met a very well-known journalist who takes some culturally liberal positions. But he told me, I'm so glad to have dinner with you because it's so good to be able to be with someone here in New York that around whom I can say I love Jesus and they're not going to look at me.
Okay. But when you look at people like Rush Limbaugh, I don't see or hear anything from him that would I've never heard him talk about religion. But he's a big part of the Republican Party.
Right, he is. And I think that on the right, among us conservatives, we have a lot of people who exploit the religion. Are we on the right, you know, we don't judge our own people, so mm-hmm. to speak, by the same standards. Limbaugh, what, he's been married four times? Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear what Limbaugh has to say about traditional marriage. He's got no credibility. And I think that, as the Bible says, we need to, you know, take the plank out of our own eye before we pluck the speck out of our neighbor's eye. So there's a lot of soul searching we have to do on our side.
Well, if people were on both sides of the political spectrum were as reasonable as you, I think we would have more thoughtful discourse. But that's not the nature of the beast right now.
No, people only want to hear what reaffirms what they already believe. That's true on the left and the right. And so we talk past each other. I've realized, Jim, in writing this book and in talking to people about it, that I don't really have anything to say about politics anymore. I don't think I do anyway. At least people aren't willing to hear it. But people, I do have something to say about life and how to live it because of what my sister showed me.
You're talking pretty well about politics right now. 297-5633, a few more minutes with Rod Dreher, and then we'll hear from the remarkable John Hightower. And Kevin, I'm having some difficulty here pulling up the people who are waiting to talk to Mr. Dreher, so if you can help me, I would appreciate it. And we'll go to a caller or two in our remaining time with Rod. A question from Mike Wolf online. He says, can you ask Rod to tell us about his work with the Templeton Foundation?
I went to work for the John Templeton Foundation in Philadelphia as a director of publications. That's a remarkable philanthropy. They spend millions and millions trying to explore the connections between science and religion. And I was with them a fairly brief time, but they do remarkable work. And they're one of the under-heralded philanthropies in the country.
Do you believe in evolution?
I do. I do, and I don't see any contradiction between that and my Christian faith.
Stephen and Hammond. Stephen, you're on with Rod Dreher. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. I just wanted to make an observation regarding the parallels between a given political party and its religious beliefs. I really think it's unfair to make generalizations about either side, whether it be the far left or the far right. There are non-believers and believers on both sides of the question. And to generalize that, I think, is really inappropriate, especially for someone who has dealt with all kinds of people historically.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I do think that my sister Ruthie's example was important to me. For Ruthie, you know, I was a guy who would sit there and argue about theology and explore theology and big ideas. As I said earlier, for Ruthie, ideas didn't really matter so much as actions. For all Ruthie's theology was Jesus loves me, this I know. God is there. He'll walk with me no matter what. And that's all she needed to know. I'm beginning to see the real wisdom of that. True religion is taking care of people and caring about them. And it's what's in your heart and what comes out in your actions, not so much what's in your head.
Well, the book is The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming. And Rod Dreher, if you read his story in the Business Report or anywhere else, this man can write with the best of them. One point I did want to make, and a listener has mentioned this, and I think it's a fair assessment, is that, and I've personally experienced it, is that some of the most moral and ethical people I've known are agnostic or atheist, and some of the least moral profess to be Christians.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, the line between good and evil does not run between religions and unbelievers, but between right down the middle of the human heart. Solzhenitsyn said that, and I believe it.
Well, thank you, Rod Dreher, and look forward to talking with you again. You're quite a gentleman, so appreciate your comments, and certainly the story about Ruthie Lemming has relevance to, I think, anybody who lives here or anywhere else. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And we're joined in studio by John Hightower, who trolls the halls of the LSU Law Center on his work days, but today he's spending some time with us. Later today, he'll be at the Baton Rouge Press Club. You've held a position of authority with the press club for how many years?
Oh, gosh, probably about 20 years.
20 years. And John Hightower and others will be there, and you are welcome to join us today, high noon at Dale Ron Hall, 323rd Street. The guest speaker today is Jim Bernhardt. That should be interesting.
We're looking forward to what Jim will have to say about, I think, a new business he's involved in.
Well, he might talk about some political matters as well.
That's right.
Running for governor, that kind of thing. He was on this show and gave every indication he's going to be in the hunt.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so we'll want to hear from
That'll
Jim Bernhardt.
That'll be interesting.
So noon today, Dale Ron Hall, if anyone would like to join us, it is open to the public. But John Hightower is involved in various and other activities. How do you make time for all this stuff?
Well, it doesn't interfere with my work, first of all, and I have always enjoyed being involved in the community. So, yes, you're right. We've got a couple of events coming up. I'm president currently of the Environment and Health Council of Louisiana.
Now, what exactly does that group do?
Well, that group's been around since the early 80s, and essentially what we do, our primary mission is to facilitate independent, balanced, and factual assessments of different health, environmental, and economic issues. So how do we do that? We usually have an annual conference that's free and open to the public where we'll focus on those three areas, either environment, health, or sometimes economic
development. Of those areas, Louisiana gets criticized. Is it deserved criticism?
Well, in some cases, certainly. But I think that all of our citizenry and our leaders in the state attempt to do the best they can to overcome some of these really great problems that we have in all three of those areas.
So who are the members of the Environment and Health Council of Louisiana?
Well, we have a independent, it's a nonprofit organization, so we're run by a volunteer board of directors. We have Unfortunately for me, most of the others that are on the board of directors are either PhDs, MDs, or JDs. Uh-huh. I think there's three or four of us who don't have those credentials.
So if a man like our producer, Kevin Gallagher, saunters in and wants to join the Health Council, can he just sign a card and you say, come on in?
Oh, sure. I mean, we're, of course, limited by our bylaws to so many board members or directors, but once we have memberships and we can, of course, take in anyone that's interested in the issues that we address.
Well, and as we
and
know,
our mission.
We've talked about it on this show with Dr. Himesfield at the Pennington Center and with others. We've got a huge problem in this city and in this state with diabetes, type 2 diabetes in particular,
yes,
because of primarily obesity. And the Environment and Health Council is hosting a summit related to diabetes.
That's right. It'll be on Wednesday this week, April 24th, from about 8:30 until 4 at Pennington. It's free, like all of our conferences, free and open to the public. And we do encourage people to pre-register, though, if they know they're coming. And the reason we have that is seating is limited, plus we'll provide a box lunch for those that pre-register.
So what will happen on that particular day? You're going to find out more about this issue? Is that the general idea?
Right. We have an outstanding array of speakers that will address prevention, care, and even some community solutions that have been effective in about three areas of the state.
All right. So that is coming Wednesday, right?
That's right. This Wednesday,
Wednesday,
April 24th.
At the Pennington Center. You start when? What time?
About 8:30, people should arrive to register.
Diabetes Summit hosted by the Environment and Health Council of Louisiana. Did you get your blood checked for that, John?
No, I don't think we'll have
blood checks. No, but I bet you do on other occasions.
Absolutely.
What's your glucose level?
Oh, I don't know.
I hear if it's under 100.
Well, I know I'm in good health, at least
last
time.
You look like it. You look like it, but sometimes looks can be deceiving.
That's right. And people do need to get checkups on an annual basis for all of the normal things that would be checked, including their glucose level.
And that's something that can be detected with a simple blood test.
That's right.
Although you need to fast before you take the test. Now, you're also involved, as John is, in many other endeavors with the March of Dimes.
That's right. I'm chairman of the Capital Division of the March of Dimes, which is the 10 parish area around Baton Rouge. And we, too, have a very important event coming up Saturday, April 27th, which is the annual March for Babies. This, of course, is essentially a fundraiser, and this year's goal is $335,000, and we actually had the same goal last year and way surpassed that, and we hope to do that
again this year. Where will we be marching for babies?
All right. The March for Babies will assemble downtown at the AZ Young Park, which is, if you're looking at the front of the state capitol, it's to the left of the capitol at the where Lafayette joins 3rd Street.
That's this Saturday.
This Saturday.
At what time?
Well, people should start arriving around 7:30. We'll actually begin some calisthenics or exercises to warm up, and then we'll start the march around 9 or 9:15.
And this is, once again, something that has relevance here because we have a high rate of infant mortality, a high rate of premature delivery. All of these are issues that affect young people.
That's right. The March Dimes mission, of course, is to improve the health of babies by preventing birth defects, premature birth, and infant mortality. And it's important that we're celebrating, I want to mark this, that we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of the March of Dimes. So it was started in 1938 by President Roosevelt. We, of course, addressed initially the defeat of polio, which was accomplished by 1954. And the health of babies, of course, has always been a focus as well.
It's amazing how many people had polio in the 30s and 40s.
Oh, yeah.
Buddy Leach is a survivor of polio. He's 79 years old now.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he is. And, of course, Franklin Roosevelt, the man who spoke, the president, he had polio.
That's right.
And now almost nobody gets polio, but we do have other issues that are extremely
important. Premature birth is a big problem for the whole country. About 500,000 babies actually die from premature birth. I'm sorry, premature birth happens in 500,000 cases. Excuse me. And in
500,000 cases in
throughout the country. It's one in seven out of about 9,000 births in Louisiana.
What is considered a premature birth?
Well, if you're prior to the 39 weeks, it could be premature, but normally, as you probably know, a lot of C-sections are done earlier, and that would not be a premature birth. Now, I'm not a physician, so I can't comment on all of that, but in a scholarly way, but prematurity happens quite often, as I said, in Louisiana and throughout the country. We are, of course, advocating a program right now through the March Times called Healthy Babies Are Worth the Wait, right. And that's a campaign that's been successful in that most of the hospitals in the state have signed up for it.
All right, so let me get the schedule down. Saturday, 7:30, AZ Young Park, March of Dimes. Wednesday, early in the day, 8-ish or so.
About 8:30, yeah.
At Pennington for the Environmental and Health Council. And today at noon, John Hightower and Jim Bernhardt will be on hand. Jim Bernhardt, the guest speaker at the Baton Rouge Press Club.
That's right.
Well, thank you for all you do for our community.
Well, thank you for having me on today. I really appreciate it, Jim.
And thanks to Rod Dreher and to you for listening. Until tomorrow, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.